You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. Game relevant. That's right, folks, we're game relevant now because we're recording on a Monday after the football's happened and not before. Imagine that, a football podcast, game relevant. Welcome to Alex Stewart.
Hi, Joe, how are you doing?
Game relevant. And Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Joe Devine.
Game relevant. Today, we're going to talk about Newcastle, Southampton. We're going to talk about Manchester United, Everton, Wolves, Leicester, and of course, Liverpool, Man City. And we're not going to do the play-by-play of the other game-relevant podcasts. No, no, no. Leave that good work to their fine hands. For us, we're going to talk about broad themes, but relate them to the games. Game relevant. And of course, before we get started, I would like to remind you that if you're into game-relevant topics and things such as the TIFO Football Podcast, you might enjoy the game relevance of The Athletic, and because they're, you know, they're actually not that game-relevant, because most of what they do is a longer read or a reflection, broad themes, much like the TIFO Football Podcast. But you know what? It's absolutely fantastic. Every morning on the Monday, I wake up and I read David Ornstein's column, and I learn more about what's happening in the world of football then than I do spending time with my colleagues Alex and Seb all week. Isn't that true, Alex and Seb?
Sure is, Joe.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. So if you want to learn along with us about what's happening in the world of football, as well as following your club with in-depth and dedicated football journalists, then you should go to theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO for a deal that I believe is currently available. It's a 7-day free trial. You don't even need to, I think, pay any money. So just go and look at it, and you've got 7 days to do that. And then if you come back after 7 days and you don't like it, just cancel it, and it's all fine. Might still actually count as some kind of sign up for me. So even though you wouldn't be like a totally converted sign up, you would count as a statistic.
It's and not you never really know,
maybe I'll
problem.
Get a raise. Is that, yeah, who cares? I'm just a conduit and a good one at that. Hey, The Athletic, thanks everyone there. Anyway, game relevant. Who's ready to be game relevant?
I am.
Alex,
Okay. Moderately, I suppose.
Moderately. Yeah, all right. Oh, here we go. I leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of game relevance. Okay, let's begin with Manchester City, who of course beat Liverpool 4-1 at Anfield over the weekend. Football relevant. Of course, the big talking point from this game was Phil Foden, who I rather embarrassingly text Alex to say at half-time, he's looking rather ineffective, isn't he, in that position. Didn't I, Alex?
You did indeed, yes. Although you weren't wrong, he changed possession.
Do you want to tell me why he wasn't? That's true. I think I was reading Michael Cox this morning, and Michael Cox said that he played in four different positions. The thing is, you responded to me with a very fair point, which is to say, yes, everyone does. So, you know, don't pick on Phil Foden. And you were right, because in the second half, he really took the Grame by the grasp of its neck. The Grame he took.
Yes, the Grame became his. City in the second half were far more fluid in a sort of front four with Bernardo Silva buzzing around into the wide areas, acting kind of as a 10 in a slightly De Bruyne-y style. Foden was able to make these runs through, but he was positionally swapping, particularly on the left-hand side with Sterling. And it just, when you've got inexperienced centre-backs like Liverpool have, that kind of movement and rotation makes it much harder for them to ignore their natural instinct to push forwards, which is as a midfielder is what you want to do. And that created gaps behind or put confusion into the minds of the centre-backs. And that's how they won the penalty in the first instance, but it's also some of the movement that then allowed Gundogan to make these late runs to score.
Yeah, I mean, Seb, will you tell me a little bit about the way that he's been handled by Guardiola? Because it's only his 59th Premier League appearance since 2017. He's been a hot prospect for some time, but the commentary team, you know, yesterday was describing this as perhaps the day that he's come of age. What do you make of all of it?
Yeah, it's strange because it feels like Phil Foden has been a topic for a really long time. And yet this was only, I think, his 59th Premier League appearance. And he kind of became first team relevant in around 2017. So remember that that was the year when the under-17s won that World Cup over in India and everybody went crazy for Phil Foden. It was really hard not to get excited about a player like that. He was kind of like this generation's more real and more likely Jack Wilshere, basically. And we all wanted to see him. And there was this period of time where even in games where City were comfortably favoured, so they'd be at home to some sort of bottom-of-the-table dwelling side, you know, Foden would get like 6.5 minutes at the end. And it was frustrating because you want to see a player like that. But Guardiola's been proven correct on this because his game time is gradually increasing and has gradually increased over the last couple of years. And you guys were talking about sort of his first half performance. I feel like last season he would have been taken off. Would have been a kind of, okay, well, we've given the kid a go in a game of this caliber. Right, let's put on somebody else. Let's put on
There was a moment when Mahrez came off, actually, and was replaced by Gabriel Jesus, with Foden moving out to the right. And I think certainly if it wasn't half-time at that point, it would have been Foden coming off instead.
I completely agree. And that felt like a really pivotal moment, not just in the game, but in his career. It was a sort of, I know we're probably guilty of overanalyzing these kind of things, but it felt like you are now of sufficient influence to be too important to take off in this game. And also, you know, we're going to give you a little bit of license to be a bit crap for an hour on the basis that for the last half an hour, you might take over the game. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and he certainly did, didn't he? I mean, his goal involvements were supreme, not to mention the smash into the back of the net. Of course, it was all helped by Alisson having a bit of a brain melt. Alex, what did you make of this as an ex-goalkeeper yourself?
I mean, yes, obviously there's a bit of a brain melt. The clearances were poor. Partly, I think, there was not as much movement from the centre-backs or the left-back with one of those passes as you would like to try and give those options. It seemed like no one noticed that there was a City player just kind of lurking there ready to intercept for the second one. I guess once you've made the first mistake, you're probably maybe dwelling on that a little bit too much, and that makes a second mistake significantly more likely. I think also jumping ahead ever so slightly, that may have been an issue with De Gea. Obviously, the second goal he sort of palmed weakly, and the third one he didn't come for nearly assertively enough. And I do wonder whether goalkeepers have that thing where if they've made an error, then that is too much of their thought process, and it can be very difficult to clear that out of the mind. But Liverpool's defensive movement didn't help either.
I mean, it makes me feel rather comfortable, really, because I mainly remember a time when Liverpool didn't have a very good goalkeeper or had a goalkeeper that was prone to making, you know, semi-regular mistakes. So I wore it like a warm blanket, is what I'll say. It felt fairly significant as well for the reason that of the squad that City fielded at Anfield on Sunday, not a single player had won a game in that stadium, and only Sergio Aguero had experienced being in the lead there at any point. That's a very significant thing to overturn. How much does that kind of thing matter, do you think, Seb?
I was more surprised by the statistic, actually, Joe, because if you think about the players and teams that encompasses, that's an amazing stat, that all of those players have kind of melted away at Anfield. I think it's important because I think it's... and actually, we have a video that you could reference for this, but it involves... Yeah, you know what I'm going to plug?
No.
It's the self-efficacy video about Liverpool's comeback in Istanbul. And it's about how if you have positive experiences in adverse situations, which this might have been because they missed that first half penalty, and any player in that side who had suffered defeat at Anfield before would probably have kind of, their mind might have drifted to the same old place, especially after, let's be fair, Mohamed Salah went down kind of theatrically for Liverpool's penalty. You were all over the WhatsApp chat after that, John.
You were furious.
Well, I was, because, do you know, and producer Adonis, he pistol whipped me, producer Adonis did, and he said, hey, he's got every right to go down there. And I said, hey, producer Adonis, firstly, keep it zip, mate. This is for talent only, this WhatsApp chat. Second, that's not true. Second, it's not so much that he of course he had the right to go down. That's the way that modern football works. It's the theatricality involved. It's the grimace, the cry of pain, the contortion of the face. You know, it just makes me go, come on, man, just fall over for fuck's sake. There's no need to do the face thing. And that applies to all players who make the face, you know, just don't make the face.
I'm gonna take us away from the face back to self-efficacy, just because I feel that's a safer place to go. So basically, the principle is that if you have a positive memory that you can draw on in certain situations. So like if you're a forward, you've scored a hat trick on a certain pitch against a certain team. That is a positive experience which you can then draw on to instruct something that's happening in your present or future.
This is like Harry Potter. This is like when Harry Potter has to perform the Expecto Patronus job.
As soon as Seb started talking here, I was thinking this is something Joe is going to take in some random tangent now, because it's just
not even that random though. Like, that is Harry Potter. I know J.K. Rowling's a bit on the nose, and she calls, like, you know, a ball that helps you remember a remember brawl or whatever. But that just makes me think of Harry Potter. Anyway, I'm so sorry. Carry on.
There's a theory in everything. It's you remember that rabbit hole I went down for like 4 days when I was writing that script?
Yeah, I do.
This is what happens when I'm given slightly abstract projects to do.
Well, Expelliarmus. The only other thing I'd like to say about this game is that I particularly enjoyed it because it was the penultimate game of the weekend. And when a big game is the penultimate or the final game of the weekend, it's not necessarily that it is improved in terms of results or goals or even individual moments, but it really puts into context all the games that came before it, which we will come on to discuss, of course. The main thing I notice as a sort of non-analyst is, oh God, they have a lot less time, don't they? And they have a lot less space. And I've spent the whole weekend sort of watching the teams thinking, why aren't they passing it through that sort of narrow corridor there? Sure, it's a narrow corridor, but I feel like that's what players in this league do. And they don't do it and they take a safer option. Or, perhaps the players just don't have that level of confidence or that level of skill. And even in the first half of Manchester City, the Liverpool-Manchester City game, which was, a bit damp in most places, the amount of space and the amount of time that the players had is so much less than that of almost every other game this weekend that you just see that gulf in class. It's incredible to watch, isn't it?
There's a point to be made here about like the average pattern of most Premier League games, which is big team against weaker team and build up starting under very little pressure amongst centre halves and fullbacks and deep midfielders, and then a kind of gradual build into a zone. Whereas this was kind of, it's more frantic, isn't it? Everything is more congested. Yeah. And it's much more back and forward.
There's a challenge every stage of the game.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought in the first half, actually, City progressed the ball out of their half really, really well. They were lacking the right level of movement and focal point up front, which is why I think the Bernardo Silva Foden switch happened. But Man City's technical ability to move the ball under pressure was remarkable. Certain of the passes that they made, particularly Gundogan was good at this, I think, just showed a level of technical excellence. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a pretty frantic pace in terms of the pressing. And I don't think Liverpool had that same degree as they usually do. So irrespective of the fact that the first half didn't really see much in the way of end product, I was quite impressed with the way that City moved the ball forwards.
As you should be. I would say, I think, to round this bit off, this is a very significant result, not only for the sort of historical precedent for the players of Manchester City, but also because it puts them 10 points ahead of Liverpool now. And, what went from last week, I had a conversation with my granddad where we were talking about the madness of football. And we said, oh, isn't it nice to not know who's going to win the Premier League this year? And he said, yes, it's very nice, isn't it, Joe? And I said, yes, granddad, thank you. I love you. And now I look like a fool. But we'll be back in a second to talk about wet weather. Wet weather. Southampton, Newcastle, wet weather. Otherwise, the game known as the Game of Loans. Someone might call it that. I have. Seb's
That's
left
very
out
clever.
The pod plan, but I haven't forgotten about it, so I've put it back in, as is my want. The reason I call it the Game of Loans is, of course, Joe Willock. Exciting. You know, Takumi Minamino. Exciting. Goals. But also wet weather. And, of course, the main talking point from this game really is that Newcastle went down to 9 men and Southampton still didn't win the game. Now, perhaps that is because they're chastened from the 9-0 defeat to Manchester United. Perhaps that's because they're not very good. Not true, they are good. So maybe it's the water. I think I spoke to you, Alex, during the game and said it's looked like they've never played in the rain before. A little bit unfair, but would you explain what I meant?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty heavy, wasn't it, particularly in the second half. I think the problem that you have when you're playing against a team that's gone down to 10 or later on to 9 is that what you need to do is to move that team around a lot. And Newcastle, it's the way they've been playing all season, like to sit back, like to condense, particularly the centre of the pitch. And as we did in our parking the bus video, one of the best ways to get around that is to move the ball from side to side, drag the team one way, drag them the other, and then look to create space that way. Of course, that's great if you've got good passers of the ball who can whip it around. But when the surface is as heavy as it is, Southampton were struggling to get any kind of momentum on the ball. I mean, it was really, really holding up, particularly in the middle third. Of course, Southampton are
also... Every pass looked underhit, didn't it?
Massively underhit. Like, it was bizarre. And of course, what that also does is it creates a situation where Newcastle are probably slightly more proactive in pressing the ball than they would otherwise be, because they know that there's a good chance that the ball, if it doesn't, you know, hold up entirely, it will at least slow down. Also then in their mind, Southampton players are thinking, particularly if they're facing their own goal, who's coming behind me? This ball, you know, I'm going to pass the ball. It's not going to necessarily fly backwards. So there's a whole added level of pressure that comes from playing in conditions like that, which particularly don't suit a team that are trying to move the opposition around a lot when they're in quite a low block.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Well, listen, we'll come back to talk about how best to exploit numerical advantages, because obviously it didn't quite work out for Southampton in this game. I want to spend a minute talking about Newcastle, though, Seb, because they were really impressive. And of course, you know, aside from the two red cards, and, you know, we've seen them defending in a low block quite a lot this season, that's not really what I'm referring to. But the way that they took their goals and created their chances is a little unlike the Newcastle sides that we've seen mostly so far this season. A big impact here, I think, was Joe Willock. And also, Miguel Almiron had a fantastic game, and Alan Saint-Maximin started his first since November, I think. So it all seemed to just come together for Steve Bruce's team on the day. Talk to me a little bit about Joe Willock, because it feels like he could have quite an influence on this team.
It does, doesn't it? I think we've talked about this a few times, about how Newcastle, at their worst, have looked like 10 players in quite a deep position, 40 yards of nothingness, and then Callum Wilson running about by himself. And it feels like, although Joe Willock isn't like an outright attacking midfielder, he's not Mesut Ozil, is he? But he's certainly someone that will go forward, and as such, feels like a nice little connecting piece. Let's also mention Graham Jones, because he came in to provide coaching support for Steve Bruce. That's a much bigger topic, and, you know, why a Premier League head coach needs to do that to kind of describe something less than ideal. But he's had an effect. Everything that Newcastle do at the moment feels a little bit more balanced. I think a lot of the flaws are still there. They're still not great defensively, and they remain, regardless of what we're saying now, they remain a work in progress with the ball. But it's healthy, and I know that the second goal, for instance, was a big deflection, and the third one needed pretty bad error from Ryan Bertrand to progress. But it's better, and Newcastle scoring 3 times at home feels like a real step in the right direction, and they were better, and Joe Willock feels like he's part of that. And also, I think one of the reasons why this loan move works, Joe, is that at Arsenal, Joe Willock is a good player, but his As a kind of a youth product, his thunder was stolen a little bit by some of the better players there, Saka, Martinelli. They're players that it's easier to get more excited by. And as a result, Joe Willock is kind of, good player. He's kind of 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10. I think Newcastle's a really good opportunity for him to show that he belongs in a slightly higher category than that.
Also, the most horrible thing about this game was the injury to Fabian Schär, who, I mean, smashed his knee against another player's body, and it looked very swollen and horrible, Seb.
It always reminds me of something very specific in my childhood. I was running through a playground, and I came around a corner, and you know those...
And you saw Fabien Char with a swollen knee.
Exactly. And it just, it has haunted me for the last 30 years. Horrible.
Good story. Yeah.
Alternatively, I came around a corner, and you know those big sort of metal things that that people used to chain bikes up to? Before they became
cranes,
a bit neater and
buildings,
a bit smaller.
Iron blocks.
Kind of looked like a mini climbing frame.
Oh, yeah. Fence.
Okay, came running around the corner, and I hit my knee squarely on one of those, and it's just the most... It's about 90 seconds of agony until everything goes back to normal, but it's a very, very horrible 90 seconds. It reminds me
of
that.
It's the square hit, isn't it? That's the thing. Because if you hit the side of your knee, you know, like it feels like it shoots through, and that's sort of okay momentum-wise. When it squares, it does that thing where it kind of goes in and out.
It's horrible.
Yeah. Well, listen, a speedy recovery to Fabien Cher. I hope he's feeling better soon. And his knee isn't bothering his sleep, you know, because that would be bad. That would be a real shame. And of course, that he can come back and play football. Alex, when you're facing a team of 9 men and they're playing a 1-4-4, the one being the goalkeeper, and I include the goalkeeper so that it doesn't sound as desperate as it did for Newcastle, how do you win the game? Because Southampton didn't do that, and it felt like they should have done.
Yeah, they really should have done. Movement of the ball at speed. Trying to create, which is why I said this thing about the pitch not helping, but it also Southampton are probably not the best side at doing this because they tend to move the ball quite deep in order to switch it from side to side. The verticality tends to come sort of in the middle third of the pitch, and then they like to pull it wide and have those runners coming inside. And I thought Nathan Redmond did okay in that regard. But tactically, I think they're a team who haven't really created solutions to exactly that kind of problem. They're particularly bad at playing against a low block anyway, because their ball progression, it's too easy to kind of stop them up in the middle. And if you can then defend the wide spaces as well, which is why they also sometimes don't do that well against teams that play 5 at the back, then it's quite easy to thwart Southampton in that regard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Let's discuss instead Manchester United and Everton now, because this was a very odd game. It felt like at times Manchester United were running away with it. It also felt like at times they were giving the game away. I'm not sure if that's the right way of describing it. But of course, we all know that Calvert-Lewin scored in the 95th minute to secure a 3-3 draw. The happiest party leaving the game, I would have thought, would be Abdoulaye Doucouré, because the commentary team bizarrely referenced about 4 different times that he scored in 2 different defeats against Man United. And I kept thinking, why are they saying this? Why have they come back to this? Is there nothing else to say about Abdoulaye Doucouré other than he scored? Now they'll be saying he scored in 2 defeats and 1 draw with Manchester United. Fabulous job. Well done there to Abdoulaye Doucouré, because that's, you know, that's the main thing. It was a Pogba and McSauce midfield. Yeah, that was interesting too. Pogba, of course, was substituted off before halftime due to an injury. Wish him all the best. Well, let's talk about Cavani also. But I would like to begin, of course, by talking about substitutes, because that's the low-hanging fruit here, isn't it? We all know we're going to talk about it because he was a substitute and then now he's making substitutions. And, you know, it's a interesting stat. Manchester United have only used 24 players this season, which apparently is the smallest, I think, or the second smallest squad use in the whole league. Unusual for a wealthy team. Seb, pick something out of what I'm saying here.
He just seems quite hesitant, Joe, both in the sense of when he makes his substitutions and the players he uses and the types of players that he brings on. I think that's more interesting to me than the number of players, because the number of substitutions, sorry, because you can spin that in either direction. You can talk about physical burdens being spread, or you can talk about cohesion. I mean, there's a lot of examples in either camp. But it just seems like he reminds me a little bit of Mauricio Pochettino. It always feels like he makes the substitutions 10 minutes too late, and there's always a little bit of conservatism to it. It's, I don't know, like, given the players at his disposal, like, for instance, the weekend, like, really, you don't, I don't know, in that kind of situation, you don't want to use a Van der Beek, for instance. Doesn't that make more sense given the situation? I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like defending Solskjaer, because I think, well, I also feel like Christian defending Twan Zabi, poor tackle, an unfortunate foul to give away at the end. But I don't think, you know, there's a lot of focus on that substitution taking place, you know, pretty much right towards the end of the game. He came on for Greenwood. Perhaps that was unnecessary. But you would say that was unnecessary in a situation where the game was a stable point, and it certainly wasn't. Because although Everton hadn't scored for a while, they had brought back two goals within the course of the second half. And the game, you know, felt not quite on a knife edge, but certainly not stable. I think that's the argument for saying that perhaps substitutions could have been made earlier. I don't know. I spoke to a friend of the podcast, Paul Ansorge, about this, and that was his take anyway, that, you know, it was less about the specific substitution towards the end and more about sort of what you're saying, perhaps something could have been changed earlier. It's a difficult criticism to levy, though, because you don't know how games are going to go. There's also the opportunity, you know, option that you make those substitutions, you change the game state, and, you know, suddenly you're losing the game. So I'm not sure there's a huge amount of evidence beyond this game, put it that way.
I have a bit of a weird theory, which I'm going to air publicly and expose to ridicule. But whenever I've been at Manchester United games, and that's not for a while at the moment, but obviously sort of for about a year after Solskjaer was took charge, it seems like they make these decisions by committee. So obviously Mike Phelan's involved, Michael Carrick's involved. Seems like occasionally Kieran McKenna gets involved there. I wonder whether some of the delay is not based on trying to reach a consensus in that situation. It may be me reading something which isn't there, interpreting something that isn't there, or sort of imposing my prejudice against Solskjaer and his kind of slightly, not, he's not a dominant coaching figure, is he? And so I'm wondering whether I'm sort of interpreting something that doesn't really exist. But it does feel as if there's just too much hesitation.
I'm not sure that we can. I mean, are you saying this based on, you know, inference you've drawn from watching them talk to each other?
Yeah, hopeless bias. Absolutely. But all I'm saying is that he's hardly an autocrat, is he?
How do you know?
No, but I've said that I don't. I'm making a massive assumption, which I've chosen to air on the pod.
I don't know. Have you ever seen a film about a cult? You know, where like the cult leader seems really nice and democratic, but actually they're not. Have you seen the film The Beach, where you didn't think that, Tilda Swinton had it in her, but she did, you know?
I'm always left with the feeling that, you know, when I've watched a film about cults or a documentary about cults, I've always been left with a kind of, really, you didn't see it coming. Like if you watch the Jonestown documentary, or, you know, the one about the
ending.
But it was just like, you know, I mean, what was the sex cult one with the hugely creepy guy with the ponytail? You just think, really? You didn't want to, you want to place your entire faith in that guy? I mean,
sure.
I don't know how we got here, but it's a valid point to raise
He was the manager of a Norwegian team, I think. And then he used to play at the club. Not absolutely not saying that Ole Solskjaer is the leader of a sex cult, by the way. That was just a hapless segue. Alex, tell me about Cavani, though, because, you know, we released a video today as we're recording. Cavani must start. He must start. He did start in this game. It's clear that it's not just Tifo that thinks this. It's I think it's everyone in the world now on the evidence of recent games, and particularly the Everton game. You know, I know that the result was a draw in the end, but there were moments in the first half when, you know, before the first goal, which was actually scored by Cavani, Everton, one of the things they were doing well in the game was sort of closing down those opportunities for Rashford to run in from the left and Greenwood to run in from the right. Now, there were runs that were made. There were successful dribbles, but it often felt like there was a real closing off of the space. And I think, you know, 6 months ago, if you'd had Anthony Martial in at the number nine position, you're thinking, right, this is going to be a tough game because there are very few opportunities here. You're expecting or half expecting a goal from somewhere else in the supporting attacking lineup. Maybe Bruno Fernandes to hit one from outside the box. Not like he did, of course, but that Cavani was there, and that the fullbacks and the wide players could sort of lob crosses into the area, that clearly started to cause the Everton defenders concern around 15, 20 minutes, because it was an alternative option that Manchester United just didn't have 6 months ago. It makes such a massive difference, and of course it resulted in the first goal just after 20 minutes.
Yeah, that to me, that's the key point, is that Cavani is a focal point. When you've got those quick players running from the inside, obviously one of the things that they want to have is a passing or a crossing option centrally. But also the fact that Cavani can move back toward the goal and can make the central defenders think about where he is as a more physical, more abrasive kind of old-fashioned centre forward, who also has really, really good movement in the box. I'm thinking back to the header he scored against Southampton, actually, where that little peeled run around the back of a defender's blindside to stoop down and head the ball in was just classic predatory centre-forward play. And as soon as you have that, you know, with Manchester United being a counter-attacking team that like to run forwards with pace, the defenders aren't thinking, okay, well, I just need to step up to this guy, block this run off. There's also Cavani in the central areas creating that kind of confusion. And I also think he adds a lot with his pressing game. I mean, not, you know, Martial is not a lethargic forward, but Cavani is a very disciplined and aggressive presser of the ball. And I just
he's
think
scary.
He is a bit scary.
Like, the difference between being a defender and having Cavani running at you, like screaming, versus Anthony Martial running at you. You know, not to degrade Martial, absolutely fantastic player, wonderful silky skill, but I feel like he'd be whispering at you if he was running towards you. And I feel like, you know, you thought if you could turn away from him once, he might sort of give up a bit, you know? Whereas Cavani running up, I'd be terrified. I'd want to walk around with a cricket bat to protect myself.
Well,
I'd probably break his back.
I think Martial is also somebody who benefits from having space to run into himself. And it felt like United's forward line, and that's perhaps why they excelled at a certain type of counter-attacking for a while as well, was that all of those players wanted to do a similar kind of thing. And if they all managed to get that thing together, then it was kind of bewildering for defences. But at the same time, that, you know, if you're playing against three players that all want to do the same thing, you can take certain strategies to mitigate that. All of a sudden, putting Cavani into that mix, United have two different ways of going forwards. Those crosses into the box have got a target. I also think there's an intangible thing here, which is Cavani just has a huge amount of top-level experience. You know, that forward line, particularly with Greenwood, and, you know, if Martial at 24 is your oldest striker, then there's maybe it's lacking a little bit of that nous, a little bit of that wherewithal to see out games or to you know, sniff out those little opportunities. It's kind of like what we were talking about with Liverpool and Man City. And Cavani has consistently been there and done that throughout his career. And I think that's quite a significant benefit for United as well.
Well, here's a thought for you. I think not only is the team better with Cavani in, and again, hate to do this to young Tony, great chap, fantastic footballer, but I also think one of the issues with Martial and Rashford playing alongside each other is that they often seek to run into the same space, right? Depending on who picks up the ball, where there's this kind of area of space in the left-hand side channel that both of those players naturally want to drift into. And they can't always do that. They often end up getting a little bit in each other's way. They do have, you know, the ability to knock the ball around to each other and work around each other because they've played together for a long time. But I actually think having Cavani as that focal point in the centre Rashford learning and starting to know where he's going to be at any given time, and knowing that that space is probably going to be available for him, I think it makes Rashford a better player over time. I think it gives him experience of games where he commands that area. He knows it's his, and he, you know, I think we saw in this Everton game, his dribbling has just come on leaps and bounds in the last year, and he started as a superb dribbler. I honestly think Rashford could end his career as one of the best dribblers in the world. And Greenwood on the right-hand side, you can see Cavani throughout the game sort of shouting at him, not in an aggressive way, but in a kind of, you know, an educating way. You can see him telling him when to loft the ball in. You can see him telling him when to come. Cavani runs to make space for Greenwood when he knows he's going to shoot. I think Greenwood, who potentially could end up as a nine in his career, learning from Cavani at this point, it just feels like the perfect balance for me. I don't know what you think about that, Seb.
Yeah, another thing I really like about it is I wonder if you're a centre-half, I wonder what the experience of playing against Cavani is like. I've always thought that I agree about Martial, like his traits are slightly more predictable. I've also started to notice how often he receives the ball at a standstill. Like, he just waits for the ball to arrive at him, I mean, outside of counter-attacking opportunities, which I think makes him easier to defend against. Whereas Cavani never seems to stop moving. Aside from that kind of cricket bat thing, which made me think of Spinal Tap's manager earlier. Sure. I drifted off into a kind of, yeah. I wonder whether, like, the increased tension that you feel as a defender, it's quite unsettling. I think you need a little bit of an academic study to work that out. But it feels like the general level of flux and disorientation that a Cavani type would create is to the benefit of players like Rashford and Greenwood around them, and probably a kind of a Bruno Fernandes behind.
I think you can look at, I would suggest Vardy having a similar effect for Leicester, where you've also got mobile wide players that like to run inside. You've got a 10 that's capable of making runs into the box from deep or creating shooting opportunities from outside. And then as a focal point, you've got a striker who is constantly moving, who has that ability to make even the smallest step effective by getting him away from a defender. And that means defenders have got to be aware of so much more than they would if you weren't playing against a centre forward of that calibre. And I think it suits both of those teams immensely to have that kind of player up front.
It also left me thinking, Seb, that Dominic Calvert-Lewin would actually be a good Manchester United striker after Cavani leaves, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's even arguable. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, just in terms of everything he does, like, we know we've talked about his skill set before, but like the personality is quite similar as well, which is, or could be in the future. It's really interesting.
He's such a good footballer. Yeah.
17 goals.
Yeah, he really is.
He really is. Also, Bruno Fernandes scored a fucking amazing goal, didn't he? So we'll leave it at that.
So but, good.
I appreciate that we've just spent quite a lot of this time talking about how good United's attacking line is. Of course, they didn't win the game. I don't know if it is worth spending a little bit of time talking about Everton. Because as we say, Calvert-Lewin, again, proved himself to be a difficult opponent. And James Rodriguez scored a goal, made a goal. I mean, his goal involvements have been fantastic so far this season. He's a great player, Seb.
I love the crispness of that half volley of it, of the equaliser. It's just such a neat little passage. It's so quick and precise and clever. It's just fun to watch.
And speaking about players with experience, you know, we could include him in that. Alex, I really like the way that Carlo Ancelotti has fit him into this system too, because we were all, I suppose, kind of expecting him to feature more centrally when he arrived. And actually, he's been playing on the right of that forward three to great effect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where what a player does is not necessarily determined by where they start on the pitch. And what he's able to do is whether he's playing, I mean, he was sort of slightly at the tip of a diamond in this game, but when he's playing on the right-hand side as well, he'll still drift in and find those spaces. And I think what was particularly nice with the way that Everton set up in this game was they allowed Richarlison to have that sort of free roll on the left-hand side. And so it created this tilting thing where Richarlison was able to make quite deep runs on the left-hand side. James Rodriguez could either drift out right or occupy a central space, and then Calvert-Lewin was the focal point. And I think that unbalanced thing created a situation for United's defenders where they weren't quite sure where the threat was going to come from. And once Everton started finding Richarlison in that left-hand space, particularly through Rodriguez getting the ball to him, but also from deeper, then Everton were able to attack United in a much more cohesive way. But he just, yeah, I mean, Rodriguez is just one of those players that can execute things that, that other players can't even see, let alone do.
Yeah, well, you know, GGs to all involved. We'll be back in a minute to talk about Wolves, Leicester, and some fun stuff. Okay, Wolves and Leicester. A couple of talking points here. Of course, Leicester held to a 0-0 draw. Will they lose the title now? I don't care. William Jose, or William Jose, I think he's Brazilian, isn't he? William Jose, he's a new striker that Wolves have brought in. Of course, Raul Jimenez is still out, suffering from that awful injury. And they really needed... They really needed a striker. Who wants to talk about this striker? Because he scored a lot of goals in La Liga, from what I have read.
He has scored a lot of goals in La Liga. He got double figures in his last four full seasons for Real Sociedad. He seems like a much...
Do you know what they call that, Alex? They call that a hot dog player, yeah? They call him William Hot Dog Jose because of the number of goals he scored makes people want to say hot dog.
Okay. Yeah. I guess. It's not much I can do with that. He seems like a much more natural fit for Wolves' style in that he's able to drop off. He's able to collect the ball. He's quite a big guy. He's like 6'1", 6'2". Takes the ball well under pressure and then sprays it out to those quick, tricky, wide players that Wolves had. He then has the pace to get forward. So I think he's able to mimic what Raul Jimenez offered in build-up significantly more than maybe Fabio Silva did. What's quite interesting as well is that I think he's adapting quite nicely to that style. At Sociedad, he was much more of a close focal point. So Sociedad had a more structured style of build-up with lots of shorter passes. And he was expected to very much just be in the six-yard box to get on the end of clever balls, particularly from the wide players. So he's adapting well, which I think shows good intelligence. And he looks like a good signing for them. I have to say, I didn't really know anything about him before he came to the Premier League. He's kind of, despite that good scoring record, he was slightly... off the radar for me, but I've been impressed.
Well, let's see how he does. There's another player I'd like you to talk about, Seb, and that is the player Pedro Neto, who, of course, you know, without Jimenez and Jota, has clearly been Wolves' most dangerous attacking player, and he looks like Rob Stark.
Yes, he does. He's also fun to watch. I think he's quite old-fashioned, isn't he?
Yeah, young Wolf. I last season, I suppose... his place in the kind of in the conversation was as the unluckiest player in the whole of football, because everything he seemed to do well, at least, was ruled out by VAR for about 6 months. He has that quality that Gareth Bale used to have, which is he's able to sustain his acceleration over long distances, which, you know, alongside things like skill and the ability to finish and he's nice crosser of the ball, just makes him incredibly watchable. Also, for a team who at the moment are having to go south to north as quickly as possible, they're not building attacking moves that well, or at least they weren't until William Jose turned up. He's very useful because he can take advantage of space and numerical mismatches. You could see him turning into a really, really good player. As and when Wolves, if Wolves are returned to their kind of Raul Jimenez best and they replace Diogo Jota in their system, or if they can keep Daniel Podence fit, you can see him becoming really productive in the future.
Absolutely. I think the key is that he is just fun to watch. I mean, he made so many dribbles in this game with Leicester. He ran Ricardo inside out for that whole first half, and it looked like, obviously, if there was going to be a goal, it was going to come from this left-hand side. But he just looked like he was having fun. It was quite exciting. Whenever he got the ball, I was sort of hoping that something would happen. He looks like Rob Stark, and that makes me feel good. And he's the young Wolf, you know, so hopefully he can be good. As we know from the future, looking into the future, that skill that you've described of acceleration over long periods of time, that really disappears the older you get. So
doesn't hang about for very long, I don't think.
Yeah. Heed the words of Gareth Bale, Pedro Neto, young Wolf. You know, fair fortune.
So very pleased to welcome Sky Sports' Reece Chambers to the pod. Reece is a football recruitment consultant for Sky Sports, which is a very, very smart data company based in the Netherlands that helps football clubs with recruitment, profiling of players, and so on. We're going to talk a little bit here about what is called GBE, which stands for Governing Body Endorsement. It's a post-Brexit issue that is now applied to UK football clubs by the FA. It's basically a series of criteria that will determine whether or not a player can be signed by a club or registered for a club. So it'll be things like senior international appearances, domestic league minutes, and so on. So Reece is going to talk us through some of the impact that this will have on clubs. We'll take a look at some examples and basically work out what it means for the future of recruitment for British clubs. So Reece, welcome to the pod.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Alex. Good to join you.
So this GBE, obviously, it's a post-Brexit thing, and it's here to add, I don't want to say a level of difficulty, but it's certainly going to focus the way that clubs work on their recruitment. So can you just talk me first through what kind of an impact it's going to have on the sorts of moves that British clubs can make?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're definitely right there. It does add an extra obstacle on top of an already complicated sort of market at the moment with coronavirus, obviously. But for clubs in England, especially Premier League clubs, I think it will change the way they do their recruitment. So going to different markets, definitely we will see. And I think, yeah, it's already been touted quite a lot in the media that will happen, that maybe clubs will go to South America more than they've been to cheaper markets in Europe. But I think the intuition behind it from the FA's point of view, at least, is to give more of a chance to domestic players within academy structures and things like that. Whether that happens or not is, remains to be seen over time. But yeah, in general, I think it's meant to increase the calibre of player coming over to the UK, which makes sense, I think, considering the number of younger players, especially from overseas, that have come over and maybe not reached the standards that they should have. So I think from that point of view, it should be a positive thing for the English game. But yeah, as you say, it will definitely create and already has created obstacles for clubs from a recruitment point of view, for sure.
So Sky Sports has created a points calculator, which is a way of working out whether or not a player is likely to be eligible. Can you just walk me through the basic criteria that crop up in that calculator, the sorts of things that clubs are going to have to pay attention to now?
So the FA released a very lengthy document towards the end of last year, actually detailing the regulations that would be put into place. So from a club's perspective, the main things they'll be looking at are the league quality of the current club, international appearances, both senior and youth, things like that, and also continental progression of clubs, both in Europe and also South America, across the world as well. So there are plenty of things they need to consider. So from our point of view, developing a model, it's been a fairly a tough process to do because they're brand new regulations to put in place. But from what we've done and from having looked through the FA's document and spoken to clubs, we think it's something that will be very useful.
So in terms of clubs, let's look at the Premier League, for example. If you're Manchester United or you're Manchester City or you're Arsenal, there's a very strong possibility that the sorts of players that you're looking at, even if they're towards the younger end of the spectrum, would still be eligible under these criteria because you're generally speaking recruiting from top five European leagues, you're looking to buy players that are already comfortable with continental football and so on. Is this really going to have much more of an impact on lower Premier League clubs, Championship clubs, or will there also be subtle adjustments to the way the bigger clubs have to recruit?
Yeah, I think you're definitely right there. I think on the whole, it will affect, clubs in the lower half of the Premier League that perhaps need to go to cheaper markets and have done traditionally. They are less feasible now. Same for Championship clubs as well. They tend to do a lot of their shopping in Bundesliga 2, leagues like that, that players aren't going to straightforward pass. That doesn't mean they won't pass in some cases. But on the whole, as you say, the top definitely the traditional top six of the Premier League probably will be largely unaffected, but on a more subtle level, the changes do mean that they probably will have some issues with signing players younger and getting there before European clubs. So maybe it does give European clubs a bit of an edge. So I know Fabregas has been cited quite a lot from his move to Arsenal back in 2003, I think it was. So those moves are less likely, especially considering you can't sign under 18s. But on the whole, yeah, I don't think there's going to be the wide sweeping impact that we've seen lower down the division, that's for sure.
Is there a possibility that this is just going to entrench the positions of the top clubs, the ones that can straight away, A, afford to pick up a player who may only be 19 or 20 but is still getting regular minutes in a top European league or a top South American league, but also have the financial clout both to run a really, really strong academy and also poach younger academy players from smaller clubs? It seems like this is an opportunity that those really established clubs have to kind of put the squeeze on everybody else, both in the domestic market and the foreign market.
Yeah, 100%. And I think one of the main things looking at it from a theoretical point of view is that it does make it more competitive. And when you have a more competitive market, the people who come off better are the people that can afford more. So I do think you're right there. But in general, I think especially within recruitment and what we found as a company is the more clubs are receptive to innovation and to creativity in their recruitment processes, the more they'll get out of the resources they have. So every club has their own internal restrictions or battles, so to say. So I wouldn't say it's a negative thing across the board, but yeah, you're definitely right in terms of the top clubs maybe getting a bit more of an edge. But yeah, who knows how they'll react to it. I think only time will tell with that.
So recruitment is one of the areas where data in football has had a real impact. And obviously this is the kind of the money ball effect, quote unquote, where people are looking for, you know, undiscovered gems for metrics that might correlate to success in a way that the rest of the market hasn't recognized and so on. What are the sorts of strategies that clubs can look to use? I've very, very briefly referenced, for example, buying to loan, but are we going to see people pushing into markets where maybe that wasn't the case previously? People buying players with a view to sending them somewhere else? What sorts of approaches will clubs likely take?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, I don't want to totally unavoid it, but it takes time with recruitment. And I think with COVID having come as well at the same time, I think it's at the moment hard to decipher what's COVID and what's GBE, because when you have two very big things coming at the same time, perhaps it's hard to decipher between the two. But in general, I would say groups of clubs will become more important. So we've obviously got City Football Group, but other clubs at the top, establishing partnerships in Europe and elsewhere as well around the globe, that will become important to perhaps drawing up a career pathway for a player. So if they find a player who's, I don't know, 17 or 18 in a market that they can't bring him over GBE-wise, possibly they'll decide to loan him out to that club where he then might earn the points eventually. So I think as I mentioned earlier, it does really bring on innovation and creativity. So from that perspective, I think it'll be interesting to see what clubs have to do. There are a few loopholes and clubs will always find loopholes around things. And maybe loopholes isn't even the right word because they're playing by the book still. They're just being strategic, which obviously within such competitive markets is something that should be very, very encouraged, I would say, to try and get that edge.
You mentioned Bundesliga 2 previously. Obviously, there were some players that came over to clubs like Norwich and did well from there. I'm also thinking of West Ham recently recruiting Suchek and Kufal from the Czech top division. What are the leagues that we should be looking at now, maybe that we previously hadn't paid that much attention to, on the basis that it's likely that players from those leagues would qualify?
In terms of looking at specific leagues, I would say the Moises Caicedo deal from Independiente in South America is pretty much the the tipping point, the example that clubs really expect, or the media, I would say, expected for clubs to go over to South America, where players are earning points not only through their league, but also through the Copa Libertadores, Copa Sudamericana. So those leagues are very important for that. And I think the talent over there, obviously, is a very big positive. Whether that means European markets are less viable or less sought after, again, it remains to be seen. But in general, I would say there has been some shift towards South America right now. Whether that just makes everybody flock over to South America and then the competition over there is just as hard, I'm not sure. But I would say that looking at it on paper, heading over to South America is not only a GBE thing, but also it's a cheaper market as well in some places. So that could be a positive that clubs look at.
Talking of South America, obviously Manchester United recently signed Facundo Pellistri from Peñarol. They also picked up Ahmed Diallo, who was playing in Serie A for Atalanta. Would both of those deals likely have gone through under the new set of rules?
Yeah, with Diallo, I don't think there's any question around that because, yeah, as you mentioned, he'd been playing in the top European league. So I think in terms of that, he would have been fine. Pellistri is another one who's more interesting, especially, as I just mentioned, coming from South America as well. It could be on the periphery, to be honest, and that's something around the GBE that when we're speaking to clubs, we do make quite clear is that the FA have set their stall out in terms of the regulations, but there's also an appeals process that clubs can go through. So in terms of that, if they do, for example, if a player has 10 points or up to 14 points, they can appeal that. So in the case of Pellistri, I'd say he probably would have fallen within that bracket. And then, of course, you have the fact that he's a very talented young player. So I don't think there would have been any issues eventually. But of course, as we mentioned at the beginning, it's another obstacle for the clubs especially to deal with. And it's not a cheap thing either. It takes time. And as everybody knows, time is a very valuable commodity within the transfer market.
Yeah, I suppose particularly because with the easier access to data and video scouting now, there isn't really a part of the world that is more hidden than any other. I think that's one of the biggest changes that we've seen. So just before we go, I suppose my final question to you would be, do you think when we look at this in 5 years' time, we're going to see a lot more young English players coming up through the ranks and progressing into the first team in lower ranking clubs? Or is this one of these things that, you know, there'll be an adaptation period, of course, but actually the landscape isn't going to change too much over the longer term?
I think in general, it should help the chances of players being able to come through an academy, whether that transpires into regular first team minutes and, you know, eventually strengthening the national team. I'm not 100% sure on that. I would say that it is a positive thing on paper for English clubs, but as we've mentioned, clubs are very strategic in the way they go about recruitment. And that's obviously a positive because they get the most value out of the money that they have and the resources they have at hand. I think probably a lot of it is down to managerial situations as well, whether managers are open to, let's say, promoting players from the youth team and the youth setup. I think further down the chain, it's a big positive for younger players in England especially. But whether we see more English players coming into the Premier League and the national setup at a higher level, I'm not 100% sure, but I'd say in general, it's a good thing. But yeah, as we say, we'll see when the time comes around in 5 years. And yeah, we'll see where we are then. I'm sure the game will be a different place by then, but hopefully a positive one for English clubs.
Well, it's definitely going to have an impact in some regard, at least in the short term. So thank you very much, Rhys, for coming on and walking us through this complicated new element to Brexit, because we needed another one of those. Thanks very much, and we'll catch up with you again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys.
We're coming to the end of the podcast now, but I've got this thing, gang. I've got this cool thing. I thought of it over the weekend. I did it over the weekend, okay? What I did was, first I'll welcome you to Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. Yeah, very exciting. We're all excited to be here. I did this over the weekend. I thought, wouldn't it be good if for every player in the Premier League, I had a fact and a quote? And so I did it over the weekend. I made a spreadsheet for every player in the Premier League. I didn't do that because that was going to take a really, really long time. So what I did was I made a quote and a fact for every player that plays as a defender or goalkeeper for the senior team of Arsenal. And that's what I did. I promise I'm going to finish it over the course of the season in my spare time, so that whenever we bring up a player like, you know, William Jose or Pedro Neto, I can say, oh, did you know? Can't do that at the moment because I thought I was too ambitious. I started alphabetically and I started with a team that I didn't watch this weekend, and so I haven't featured the conversation.
Hang on. I'm going to rein you in there. So this thing that you told me to put on the pod plan but refused to tell me anything about, the segment is you're telling us about a secret project that's happening in the background.
No. I'm going to invite you now. I'm
going
to invite you now to ask me about any defender or goal, and that includes the second and third goalkeepers that play for Arsenal, and I'll tell you a fact about them and a quote that they've said. So, Seb, I'll ask you first. And bear in mind, don't pick a big player because they're more likely to come up in the future. And I want to get maximum value out of this because it's literally going to take me months. So pick a player that's unlikely to come up again.
Rob Holding.
Okay, well, that's very rude to Rob Holding. I feel like he probably is going to stay up in a conversation. But here we go anyway. Rob Holding. Holding has backpacked around Thailand, staying in £5 per night hostels with his friends. That's a fact about Rob Holding. And a quote from Rob Holding here, a little quote from Rob Holding: rain or shine, still having a great time. That's a quote from
his
Rob
Instagram.
Holding.
From his Instagram?
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember. Alex, do you want to pick a player?
Runa Runason.
Yes, I'm glad you picked Runa Alex Runason. Runa Alex is the son of Runa Kristinsson, a former professional footballer who is the only Icelander to have had more than 100 caps for the senior national team. Did you know that?
I did, actually. Yeah,
oh,
sorry.
Well, okay. Well, you can't win them all, can you? And, you know, Runa's quote is, football would be no fun without having this type of pressure. So it will be a challenge, but I'm up for it.
Yeah. What type of pressure is he referring to?
Don't know, mate. No idea.
That sounds very much like he's been called into the team ahead of quite a big game because of the suspension. That's that quote. Okay, that feels very situational.
Oh, I should have gone for Matt Macey, actually.
Listen, Adonis, producer Adonis is an Arsenal fan, so I'm going to invite him to unmute himself and ask for a player if he wishes. Ask for Pablo Mari, please.
Pablo Mari.
Oh, thanks. Mari once grew 10 to 12 centimetres in one summer as a child, and this actually caused him really early injury issues. Did you know that, everyone?
No.
See, this is a useful thing, isn't it? And the quote
this
from
Pablo
Mari...
This is a nice little facility.
It is. This is the quote from Pablo Mari. Pablo Mari said, "The bones in my hips grew so quickly that they weren't really bone. They were just cartilage. So every time I tried to play football, I'd get injured."
I mean, it sounds horrible.
It's not funny.
That sounds terrible.
It's not funny because obviously he's a professional footballer now. You know, he made it, but fuck me, against all the odds, clearly. Because
that's an amazing recovery.
Who grows 12 centimetres in one summer?
Which summer was it?
I don't know.
Like,
he
how
said
old
when he
was he?
10 or 12. That's what he did in his quote, I remember. But you can see this is going to be a real asset to the podcast, guys. It's going to be really asset because I know so much about Arsenal's goalkeepers and defenders now.
If there was a hypothetical situation in which a conversation that began in this segment could be supplemented by something that I know, which was related, could I add it in, or is that...
Absolutely not. Yeah. No, this isn't a place for your thoughts. This isn't for your facts, Seb. We don't want good football facts in here. You probably could, though.
Just a place for you
it's just
to
a place
laugh
for
at
me,
medical misfortune.
My facts aren't important. My facts are that Bernd Leno was a Roman Catholic and once met the Pope at the Vatican, you know. And speaking of his childhood, he said, back then, every toy was football. I think he meant was a football, but I have directly quoted.
There seems like quite a disparity between the Rob Holding information and the other guys.
Did you know that Hector Bellerin is the creative director of EA Sports FIFA's Volta mode?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know.
Well, he's like, it's a sort of, you know, Instagram Mundi Elmerk thing, isn't it? People talk about that. He has that photo shoot where he's in his back garden looking urbane.
Yeah, sure.
He should probably spend more time on foul throws.
Maybe he should. One more, because I'm getting carried away. Callum Chambers. Callum Chambers fact, just one L in the name. That's the fact. And the quote, learnt that by typing it in. And the quote is, I'm just trying to get through different phases and different blocks as and when I can. So that's the quote. But I hope we've all enjoyed Joe's player quotes and facts list. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. And there'll be more. Well, anyway, that's the TIFO podcast. Thanks so much for sticking around till the bitter end with us. We'll be back. Oh, we're game relevant. We're game relevant now. And we'll be back on Friday of this week. Also game relevant. So buckle those seatbelts in. Brace for impact. And, you know, whiplash will be maximum, but you're... But the body will remain intact. Yeah? Thanks, Seb.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks to you, Alex.
Thanks, Joe.
Many thanks, as always, to producer Adonis, and we will be back on Friday. Au revoir.